tell you a little bit about Bill. He's a tech entrepreneur, former reporter, editor, and publisher, a fellow at the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute, and a national board member of Journalism That Matters. A career journalist, he has been editor-writer for the Associated Press, for trade publications in business, law, and insurance, and freelanced for general circulation dailies, including the Boston Globe. He's a former director of the Action Coalition for Media Education. Densmore Associates develops partner and other business strategies for independent media and print publishers, including newspapers and News Trust, and an initiative to create a consumer news recommendation service. So today, he is presenting a just-completed report that he made for the Reynolds Journalism Institute called From Persona to Payment, Could Public Collaboration Sustain Journalism and Privacy in a New Market for Digital Information? Bill.
Thank you, Frank. First of all, I know it's a big commitment of time for everybody to be here today, so I really appreciate that, and I think what I want to do is try and really race through these slides, because at the very end you'll see I put them online at a link you can go to if you really want to spend more time with this. Also, if anybody wants to see the report that I'm in the process of completing for the Reynolds Journalism Institute, come and give me your email address later and I'll be happy to send it to you when it's ready. So for that reason, it may seem like I'm going at a lightning pace here, but I really want to leave time for talking. So Martin talked a little bit about what the strategy that's going on in the newspaper industry now, which I describe as milking the cow till it drops. So I think it suggests that for people who want to sustain the values, principles, and purposes of journalism, we really need some urgent action of some sort. And the challenge is that, as Martin says, we're not all really sure about what that action ought to be. I think the idea of returning to the notion of a de facto nonprofit journalism approach at the local level, which Martin says was sort of what was happening in effect when there were local stewards of news organizations, is an interesting and promising idea. But I also think that in order to sustain that, there's going to have to be some kind of national technological infrastructure. And that's really the argument that I'm going to pose for you today and ask for you to talk about it a little bit. That's the Reynolds Journalism Institute, where I've been affiliated for a number of years. So I want to talk about what RJI has done to date on this challenge, very briefly give my situation analysis for the news industry, which pretty much parallels Martin's in the numbers, describe the problems that I think need to be solved, give you some insights from the 85 interviews that I conducted over the last several months with people in and around the news industry, talk about what I think is an opportunity for news organizations to develop their business as less around products, as in print or broadcast, and more around the idea of helping people manage their personas. And then talk a little bit about the blocking problem that's making that hard now, which is the idea of platform, and I'll explain that briefly. And then I want to lay out a construct that I'm calling the Information Trust Exchange, and get your feedback on whether you think it makes any sense, to form sort of an uber nonprofit at the national level. So this is what I see is the situation today for consumers and publishers. For those of us who have information needs, information is really abundant now. I mean, 50 years ago, if you wanted to get the best daily dose of information, you went to a newspaper or to a broadcast, a local radio station, that gave you that, because that was, you didn't have access to information from anywhere, but today you do. So there's a tremendous need for curation and for a convenient way to kind of package your daily information diet, but oriented around the web rather than oriented around a print or broadcast approach. But part of the blowback from the way the world has changed is a lot of emerging worries about privacy and identity, and that's why I put on your desk some excerpting I did from a Pew study that came out last week about some very real concerns of the public around privacy. So for publishers, which is really the secondary challenge here, there's a big problem about ads no longer supporting what we're doing, because the mass market advertising world is really fractionalizing. And as a result, advertising has to be what I call more advisertising, more one-to-one advertising. So the other thing is that the tech platforms are dominating, and they're doing a lot of the innovation, and that's leaving news organizations a little bit in the dust. So how has media reacted to this problem? Well, Peter Winters, who used to be with Cox Newspapers in Atlanta, a very big group that also started a company called Auto Trader, very successful company in both print and digital. He says the main problem, and he's got a book coming out this spring about why the news industry created its own failure mode. He just says the problem is that the culture needs collaboration. When you had all these iconoclastic, independent, community-focused publishers, they got with quasi or sort of de facto monopolies. They were very independent in their thinking, which is very consistent with the values that we ascribe around the First Amendment. But the problem is that isn't working in a technical world. So the first reaction as these chains got into this world is cut, try to protect print content and harvest value, pursue mass market digital advertising strategy, and embed brand and content on social networks, which presents its own problems, actually, over time. So, as Martin told you, digital advertising isn't keeping up. There's a CPM squeeze. That's an interesting thing to look at. That gives you an idea. At one time, the advertising space was, you were an advertiser, you maybe had a relationship with an advertising agency, and the advertising agency placed the ads with your print or broadcast service. Today, and this chart is already 4 years old, there's a lot more players today. There are ad networks, there are supply-side platforms, there are demand-side platforms, there are people that do a measurement. There's everybody taking a cut along the way between advertiser and publisher, which leaves even less money for the people actually creating news. So here are the implications for democracy. Mass market reach is fading. There's an increasing polarization, the sort of filter bubble that you've heard talked about in books. You can migrate among communities and join them on the fly. It's very easy if you have Facebook to jump in and out of communities rather than be focused on a community that you live in. Everything is instant now, and also everything is measurable, and this is an important concept, by census rather than sample. In other words, it used to be that Nielsen could only measure a certain number of households that watch television sets by giving them a book and they fill out the book. Well, now on the web, every click you make can be tracked by somebody in some way. So we've moved from a sampling to a census-based world, and that makes a lot of differences. So in that world, the news organizations of the past, which were gatekeepers to information, are no longer gatekeepers. And I argue that they need to adopt a new mentality, and that is to be a sort of info valet. So just to give you an idea of the business that's at stake, I did a little bit of nosing around in the U.S. statistical abstract a month or so ago, and the figures take many years to be all aggregated by the government. So these figures are from 2009. This does not include advertising at all. This is basically subscription stuff. If you add up subscriptions to newspapers, periodicals, books, cable, pay-per-view, internet access, film, and music, including purchase of music objects, that's $147.3 billion of revenue in 2009 in the United States. Or average household media spend, not on advertising, but direct person spend on media of $1,292 a year. So the question is, how much of that do we need to sustain journalism? Now, Martin, I noted Martin's figure earlier that advertising, print newspaper advertising is now down to $17.3 billion. Now, I'm going to extrapolate and say that probably means that newspaper non-advertising revenue is probably about half that, $8 or $9 billion. So that's what newspapers are getting of that $147 billion, $8 or $9 billion. And that's part of what's available to sustain journalism. So there's a lot of opportunity or need to figure out a way to grab more of that revenue for newspapers. So I want to talk a little bit about how the Reynolds Journalism Institute has addressed this challenge, and it's to try and assess the appetite for collective action by the news industry or related fields around the news industry to help the public and democracy. So what they asked me to do is spend some time interviewing as many people as I could in the time available and get a paper put together for RJI, which some form of which will become public, to kind of assess the temperature and thinking of people to the idea of, could a nonprofit collaboration, to share technology, users, and content, help with information sales, help get some of that $147 billion for journalism? And could it provide the public with more trustworthy information choices and better privacy control? And is organizing something like that something that would be feasible now? So I want to give you just sort of quick highlights of what I learned in those interviews. First of all, significant number of people want to help with that kind of a task. It's not clear yet how deep that ability to help or willingness to help is, but the initial cut is, sounds like an idea, I want to be part of helping with that. And at least 25 of the people I talked to are willing to serve on a steering committee as we think this through, if RGI decides to step forward and help lead it. There's a real hunger in the information, in the news industry, for leadership to help figure out what do we do and how do we do it. But also a great deal of doubt, as Peter Winter's book will point out when it comes out this year, a great deal of doubt about whether that leadership capability is left in the news industry to actually step up. So another thing that people had felt was obvious is that advertising technology, advertising network technology, has leaped ahead of anything to do with content technology on the web. There are all kinds of ways that advertisers now know how to track and bucket people into their interest areas and then trade that information. That's all going on behind the scenes. They've worked out ways to settle, ways to share value for that stuff. It's not happening in the content side yet. Another thing that's really interesting is that there's 100 universities across America now that are part of the Internet 2 initiative that have figured out how to, quote, federate authentication. So that if I am a professor at the University of Vermont and I want to access a resource on a server at the University of Massachusetts, I don't have to have an account at UMass. I can arrive at the UMass server and the UMass server says, hey, if you're from University of Vermont, just log in with your University of Vermont credentials and we'll get you onto UMass. There's 100 universities doing that using a non-proprietary technology called Shibboleth and SAML. But nobody's doing that in the newspaper industry yet. Why not? So another idea which is something that a fellow who just stepped on as the chief content officer for National Public Radio talked about, is the idea that it used to be that the newspaper or your AM all-news radio station in your community was that bundle of information, that bundled information for you. But today people are making their own bundles. You know, you may have multiple daily emails that come to you that give you information about fishing, different spheres of your life. So information is becoming atomized, and there's a need to create methods for helping people to assemble fresh bundles of information. So again, as Peter Winter said, the challenge is not technology. The people I talked to said, no, we're not worried about creating the technology to do what's needed. We're worried about creating the culture, creating the business structure to do it. In the news industry, there have been spectacular failures at trying to do collaborative efforts. Back in the mid-90s, there was something called the New Century Network. Just a couple of years ago, the AP fostered something that eventually was called Newsrite LLC, and that blew up. And it was always because they had created a top-level for-profit company that certain companies invested in. And when it came to either trying to put more money into it or bringing other people into it, everybody was starting to fight over their sandbox and over who had what share of the toys. And so they end up blowing up. So one thing that was interesting is that when I talked to people about the idea of could an academic collaboration lead some kind of a federated network approach, there was a fair amount of optimism about the idea that a university or foundation approach might have the potential to overcome that past failure of equity conflicts. But also concern that, well, universities move so slowly, they move on academic time, this is an urgent problem, this is something that can be studied for 5 years, and then say, okay, now we've got this idea, what do people think? Then the last thing that people sometimes raised in talking with me was, what about antitrust? If the news industry all gets together and says, this is what we want to do. And I think that there's ample data, and in the white paper I've got a sidebar about this, that there are lots of examples of industries collaborating on infrastructure stuff, but not about pricing or terms of service. Certainly that's a no-no. But there's much, much, much that can be done about that, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. These are some of the specific initiatives that people who I talked to identified as things to watch. That I mentioned that SAML Shibboleth 100 University thing. The folks here from Vermont Public Radio know about the Public Media Platform. The Public Media Platform is an effort to create a simple interface where each public television or radio station around the country can share their content among each other. There's efforts within the advertising industry to start something called Digitrust, which would do away with the idea of cookies that track your identity and replace it with a common protocol that works across all ad platforms instead of having 20 or 30 different third-party ad platforms each putting a cookie on your computer and slowing down your computer, there would be one. There's an effort underway with the Knight Foundation and the Mozilla Foundation working with the New York Times and the Washington Post to come up with a common identity for doing posting comments across multiple websites. And then there are a number of payment strategies in the way. So distilling that down, it seems to me, from everything that I've heard from these interviews, that there's six challenges that the industry faces. One is figuring out how to overcome the culture of independence and figure out that it's okay to collaborate on a national scale. To get away from this focus on manufacturing product and airtime and think about us as being definitively in a service rather than a product business. To figure out how to tame the platform-based advertising competition. To figure out how to be a part of the audience migration to multiple platforms. And to let go of the fact that there's hardly any traffic. Compared to the traffic to Facebook and Google and Yahoo and Amazon, there's very little traffic that comes to newspaper websites. And that's not working. And that there's a lack of a shared identity system, so people are using Facebook Connect as a single logon, which means Facebook Connect pretty much knows everything about our persona. And these are the six opportunities. I'm going to skip over that. And I think the key, as I said a minute ago, the key paradigm shift we have to think about is news as a service, not as a product. That paper or broadcast are merely delivery systems. That really the challenge is to help users discover and access information from anywhere. Create a conversation in a community and a network, and that it's not just about a story, but about figuring out how to remix and repackage stories. But the problem, again, to get back to this idea of platform, the problem is that if I'm a news organization and I want to learn how to manage people's personas, the problem is the personas are now being managed by Facebook and they're being managed by Google. So, and they're not interested in sharing that data with the news industry. So my conclusion is that the news industry has to create its own platform because otherwise publishers are going to be losing touch with users. User data needed to personalize ads is not going to be available to them. If you look at the way Wall Street values companies like Facebook and Google on a per share and a return on equity point of view, it's astronomical compared to how they're valuing media companies now. And that's because they know that those entities have these really deep knowledge bases about their users. So the idea that I'm making the stopping loss argument for in this report is the idea of an information trust exchange, a public benefit entity to lead creation of a free market for digital information, builds on standards, ensures consumer choice and trust, enables price and service and competition, broadly, openly governed with a global perspective, operations and sanctions, first benefit journalism, democracy and freedom, in addition to private economic issues. Well, that's pretty esoteric. So what does that actually mean to the user? What it means is you might choose a home base to have your relationship, and it might be a newspaper or a radio station or some local organization that you have an affiliation with, that the system allows you to have one ID, one account, one bill, and be able to access information from anywhere. And that information gets used by the network affiliates to either, with your permission, ship you advertising that's relevant to your interests, or ask you to be a subscriber to that and multiple other services. An interesting approach to this is one being taken by the Washington Post. 6 months ago, the Washington Post announced that they were going to collaborate with a bunch of regional newspapers around the country, including Milwaukee and Minneapolis and Dallas. And now, if you are a subscriber to the Minneapolis Star's digital edition, You get free access to all the content at the Washington Post website for a year without having to pay anything extra. The Washington Post, which is, of course, Jeff Bezos of Amazon now owns the Washington Post. The Washington Post gets your email address, which means they have a high-value customer now that they can maybe exploit one way or another in the Minneapolis metro area. But that the Minneapolis Star Tribune now has a much more valuable package. So that's an example of a collaboration idea that's being pursued. And no money's changing hands between the Washington Post and those regional papers yet, but it's interesting to think about who has the greater value exchange there. So the potential roles for an information trust exchange would be to sustain journalism values, principles, and purposes, to establish voluntary privacy, trust, and identity standards, to research and test and commission key technologies, to sanction protocols for sharing users and content, to direct multi-site user authentication services, and to enable consumer choice around privacy. Thinking about what are the examples of this that have happened in the past? Well, if you think about the New York Stock Exchange, that was originally a nonprofit. And it stayed a nonprofit until 2008 when it actually did an IPO and went public, and now it's a regular for-profit company. But the idea of the New York Stock Exchange was people who had stock for sale and people who wanted to buy stock didn't have any way to connect with each other. And the New York Stock Exchange created that. When the cable industry realized that it needed to figure out a common way to manage how cable got into your household, they formed a nonprofit called Cable Labs that's based in Denver and does all kinds of technology research on set-top boxes and stuff like that. Underwriters Laboratories does testing of electrical equipment in your house. If you have a phone and you get in your car and it syncs with your phone so that you can have a hands-free phone, that uses Bluetooth technology. There were a bunch of really big technology companies who were all competing for near-field technology applications about 10 years ago, and they realized that they could create a marketplace for near-field technology if they just collaborated on standards, so they pooled their patents for that. If you think about railroads, when railroads started, who decided how wide the track should be? And that was sort of important. I mean, that was not a given. The track width in Britain is narrower than it is in the United States. So they had to figure that out, because otherwise you would have had to unload a freight car at the end of one line and reload it into somebody else's freight car. So the National Automated Clearinghouse Agency, you know how more and more you can use the internet to send a payment to somebody else? That all works across something called the NACHA, the ACH network. That is a voluntary association of banks that set up standards for what data they want to transfer to record payments among each other. And then one of the best examples, of course, is the Associated Press, which is actually a nonprofit cooperative set up under New York state law and owned by its newspaper members. So there's lots of examples, and the biggest example was the Visa International Service Association. Visa started out actually as the Bank of America, which was owned by Bank of America. And they tried to get banks around the country to adopt and sell the Bank of America card, and nobody wanted to do it. And they brought in a guy named Dee Hott, who was from a little bank in Washington State. And they said, help us. And he said, well, what you've got to do if you want your card to be successful is you've got to give it up. You've got to turn it over to a nonprofit association called the Visa International Service Association, rebrand it so it isn't other banks being forced to take the Bank of America brand down their throat. Call it Visa, and let all the banks own it. Well, Visa grew to become the largest worldwide exchange of value that exists on the planet today. Hugely successful. It is now actually a for-profit company because the banks finally decided they didn't want to run it as an association anymore. But it grew enormously, and in contrast that to American Express, which has always been one company that you have your relationship with, whereas with your Visa card, your relationship is with your bank. So the idea is that Visa is actually acceptance brands with thousands and thousands of actual entities that offer it. So my theory is that we need a system where there can be N number of user owners, N number of people with relationships with users. All you want is a common infrastructure. So again, there are some things going on out there that could contribute to this happening. One is the public media platform that's already done some great thinking and is launched with a common content repository. the information, the Investigative News Network is a nonprofit collaboration, sort of trade association of more than 100 local online news communities and people doing investigative journalism around the country. They're very much looking to figure out a way to federate and share their content nationally. The Local Media Consortium is a loose affiliation of most of the big newspaper chains except for Gannett and Tribune, I think, and the New York Times and the Washington Post. And they are they're collaborating on advertising now, and there's opportunity maybe for them to collaborate on other things. As I mentioned earlier, Digitrust, which is an emerging nonprofit collection of advertising networks, the Bluetooth Special Interest SIG Group. So I'm going to start to wrap up here now. Again, this idea of networks working on the net. If you think about Google and the way they do ads, Google places ads on all kinds of other websites besides Google. So Google has already figured out this idea of networking value. And they have, Google is already through a private network aggregating views and sharing out value for those views across all their affiliate networks. So that exists. There are multiple ad networks and exchanges. If you think about Amazon, if you've ever bought on Amazon, you'll notice sometimes Amazon will allow you to buy not from Amazon, but from somebody else who's using the Amazon platform. And you may even get something in the mail that is coming from another vendor. Like sometimes you'll order a book from Amazon, it'll come from some other vendor that Amazon has led onto the network. So Bezos already understands this idea of you create the platform and then you let multiple players use it. But a key challenge is figuring out who's going to own and control that, and that's part of what needs to be talked about. So what's the next step for this? Where is RGI now after it digests and thinks about the report that it's written? Well, we're thinking about the idea of forming up the steering committee and getting some work groups going, raising some phase two funding to move from this wild idea to, okay, let's actually put some flesh on exactly how it would work and who would need to build it. We want to reach out to foundations and journalism schools and philanthropists and publishers and telecoms and Silicon Valley to see to what extent they're willing to participate in this process of developing it. And we think that's a 9-month process. So just to recap, this started with the idea of the Information Ballet as a new sort of paradigm for publishers and broadcasters. We sort of scanned the landscape and thought of this as really becoming an attention age rather than an information age. That there needs to be a move from thinking about paper and broadcast to persona and payment. This hypothesis about a solution that I hope we can talk about, the Information Trust Exchange. What I really hope we can get some feedback from and in connection with Martin's conversation too is this a valid idea? Is it feasible? How do we make it feasible if it's a valid idea? But is there a completely different way to look at this? Because I'm sure there is, and maybe there's another path. But we all need to be thinking about another path, because what's happening now is not going to sustain journalism.